This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Roger Karras has always been an enthusiastic animal lover. He's lived with animals throughout his life, and now at the age of 64, he and his wife share their home with a menagerie of 28 animals. Karras has worked in both radio and television. He was resident naturalist for NBC's Today Show and was a correspondent on animals and the environment for ABC News. In the summer of 1991, he quit his job with ABC to become president of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which is involved with the welfare of animals living in New York City. Throughout his career, Roger Karras has managed to write more than 50 books on animals and the outdoors. His latest one is called A Dog is Listening. Karras said that humans have lived with pets for thousands of years, but he believes we need them now more than ever.
The human condition, I don't care what anyone says, the human condition has deteriorated. We're less nice to each other. We're more violent. We're more rushed. We have less time for each other than we used to have when we sat around the hearth. And we're judgmental of each other. Pets offer unconditional love, no judgment. So you flunked the French exam, big deal, just scratch my head. So you got fired, so you didn't get the promotion, so you got indicted for tax fraud. It doesn't make any difference to a pet. Non-judgmental, unconditional, constant love.
In the beginning of your book, you say that animals deserve something called appanage, which you define as its rightful endowment. Is this another way of saying or talking about animal rights?
Animal rights has become such a polarized phrase, expression. It gets people at each other's throats instantly. Though I believe animals have rights, I firmly believe that, I do not use the expression because to use the expression is once again to throw down the glove, to challenge, and I don't want to challenge, I want to convince people to be nice to animals. So I suggest the word appanage, which comes from the French, which means provisions made for the second son. The first son gets the vineyard, the chateau, the title, the throne, the crown, whatever. You've got to do something about your second son, so it's appanage. It came to mean, in English, what is given by tradition or natural necessity. So whether you want to argue whether animals have rights or not, you cannot argue that they have natural necessities. Every animal has natural necessities.
And what do you see those necessities being?
Because we have taken the dog from the loin of the wolf and turned him into his own species and made him totally dependent upon us, and we are the pack leader because the dog is a social animal, the dog needs guidance, leadership, above all love, and attention to its biological needs. After all, we created the dog. Now let's take care of our creation.
Let me see if I can get you to give us a very quick history of the domestication of dogs. And they come in part, or they come from wolves. What do you think the price of domestication has been for dogs?
Genetic faults. There's a whole long list of potential genetic faults in purebred dogs. The highest on the list is the Cocker Spaniel with 40 potential genetic faults. I'm talking about everything from, not so much in the cock, but everything from hip dysplasia to progressional retinal atrophy to a floating patella, that means a wonky kneecap, to all kinds of allergenic sensitivities. There are 40 listed for the Cocker Spaniel, 39 listed for the Bulldog, and even for our beloved Labrador Retriever, that big, strapping, healthy dog, there are 27 different potential genetic faults. That's because breeders have not been careful.
What about the loss of brain power? And you write in your book that about one-third of the brain, this would be from the wolf to the dog, one-third of that brain is lost in domestication.
Yes, it is. A wolf and a dog of the same weight, the brain of the wolf will be about a third larger. However, the part of the brain, this is the important part, the part of the brain that seems to have been atrophied or whatever, taken from the dog, is generally that part that has to do with sensory reception and not to do with potential cognition, which means it may not smell quite as acutely, it may not hear quite as acutely, but we still think they think. You know, Marty, 25 years ago, if you said, my dog thinks, the scientists went, ha, 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 ha. Today, graduate students in universities buy textbooks called Comparative Animal Cognition, Animal Cognition, Animal Thinking. Today, it's not if they think, it's how they think and what they think that's being studied. We were right. They were wrong.
What about that early relationship between humans and these wolves that were becoming dogs? And as you say, it was really humans that created this new species called the domestic dog.
In the Middle East, history lesson, in the Middle East, there's a small wolf. It's still found. I have heard them at night, not seen them in the Sinai Peninsula. They're still found from Israel to India. It is a subspecies of what we call the timber wolf in this country. The timber wolf here is Canis lupus. That little wolf in the Middle East over to Asia, subcontinent, is Canis lupus palpus. We believe that that was the initial animal from which domestication started. The initial domestication probably took place in the Middle East. We have breeds that go back at least 8,000 years, which are purebred, breeding true dogs. To have reached that point 8,000 years ago, it is estimated that the dog may have started to be domesticated, that is, taken out of the loins of the wolf, 250 centuries ago, about 25,000 years.
Were early people then looking for some creature to help them hunt, or were they looking for companionship?
I don't think it had a motive. I think it just sort of happened, and I'll give you a possible scenario. Well, obviously, I don't know if this is the case, but give me, indulge me in a possible scenario, or let me indulge myself. Dogs and wolves were eaten. Everything was eaten, and everything they ate, us too, by the way. I'm talking now about very early Stone Age. And it's fairly simple for 12 strapping, hulking cavemen to neutralize a bitch and her puppies in a cave or in a nest somewhere with a hail of stones. So they crept up and they threw these whole big bunch of stones and they knocked down the bitch or drove her off, and they went and they sold the puppies. They brought the puppies back to the cave. And with lack of refrigeration, you didn't kill meat if you didn't have to, until you needed it, because it began stinking in about 2 days. So you kept the puppies alive, just the way they do in parts of Asia today, in Korea, in the Philippines, in China. Then you kill them as you want them and eat them. They eat dog today, so they ate wolf then. Okay, Johnny Caveboy has got the measles. And he begins playing with one of the puppies you haven't killed to eat yet. And when it comes time to kill that puppy, the mother says, oh, come on, you sloth. Go out and get something else. Let the kid keep the puppy. He's got the measles. The pediatrician says he feels lousy. Look, he's having fun. It's the first time in a week he hasn't been crying. Okay? So they get used to keeping a puppy around. And when it came time to off it a little bit later, the kid said, no, you don't. It's my puppy. Something like that. Something in that corner of the room happened at somewhere along the line. And here and there, people began keeping a socialized wolf around.
I'm speaking with Roger Karras, and he is the current head or president of the ASPCA and has just written another book, and he's written a bunch of them. And this latest book is called A Dog Is Listening. Talking about dogs listening, and I'm sure anyone who lives with dogs know that they listen very attentively. What do you think they're listening for? And is it that they do see these people that they live with in this house as somehow their leader, and they're listening for commands, listening for so they know what to do next?
For sure. It is a madness to imagine a household where the human being was not the leader. Man is the alpha wolf in the pack, and the dogs are beta and so forth. They are listening for command. Now, I have 12 dogs at the moment. One of them is a border collie. Duncan, matter of fact, Duncan's very famous. He's the son of Mike, and Mike was the dog and down out in Beverly Hills and many other films. This is Mike's son, Duncan. Duncan is a border collie. He is all border collie. And if you don't give him something to do, if it's something to herd, he'll go herd the toilet and the bathtub. He's got to herd something. So when my grandchildren are there, that's good. You can herd them. We got 11 other dogs. He can herd them. We got 10 cats. You can herd them. We have horses, but when he tries to herd them, he gets his head kicked in, so he's not doing that so much anymore. And we have 2 pet cows, and one of them's a steer. And
don't want to hurt him, right?
The Steakums would love to make a barbecue skewer out of Duncan because he's a pain when he tries to herd him. Yeah. So he herds as best he can, usually the other dogs. And he never stops looking. He never stops paying attention. Border collies never rest. He's a perfect, nice example of what we're talking about. They are listening for orders, for commands. They're looking for a signal to tell them how they can please you.
Let me ask you about the touching relationship between animals and people, or between dogs and people. Mm-hmm. And it obviously is obviously the basis for very deep bond. I mean, somehow through this touching that goes on, there's this great bond that happens. Why certain places like the jawline or the behind the ears or even the stomach, why is that so seductive to dogs?
Well, can I back up and take it from us first?
Sure.
Without being salacious, I would suggest that touch in human beings is the most underutilized of all the 5 senses. If we indeed we only have 5 senses, except in sexual interplay. I don't know where else. Occasionally you may feel a piece of fabric or rub your hand over a piece of marble in a museum or something. But essentially, the tactile sensation is pretty much reduced to human beings to just sexual interplay. Then along comes the dog or the cat, and we pet it. We're using, not sexually, I'm not being silly, but we're using the sense of touch again in a different context. So that is pleasing for us. It is pleasing relationships. Dogs and cats have places they love to be petted, particularly the cat at the corner of the mouth, because there is a claiming gland there. When a cat rubs against you, it rubs its side of its mouth, apparently its cheek against you, your leg, or your chair leg, or the piano leg. What is he doing? He's depositing an infinitesimal drop of a chemical known as a pheromone, which is a marking device. Other cats can sense it. You would never be able to smell it. But other cats can, and they know that that's been claimed, you've been claimed. So it's a claiming ritual, and nature makes things that are important to an animal feel good to the animal, so they'll do it. So apparently it feels good to rub your jaw or your cheek against a person's leg. Again, not to be salacious, dogs love to have their chests scratched, particularly male dogs. Why? Because when a male covers a female and copulates and engages in a pelvic thrust, its chest rubs along the spine of the female. And dogs can't scratch their own chest, but you scratch their chest for them. It's got pleasant associations. Now forget I said that and go enjoy your dog.
Well, I want to talk some more, but I want to take a short break. And I'm speaking with Roger Karas. And he's currently the president of the ASPCA and has just written another book. It's called A Dog is Listening. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Roger Karas. Let me talk a little bit, if we can, about pit bulls. Mm-hmm. And do you see them as an overly maligned breed?
No. No, I don't. The American Pit Bull Terrier, ABPT, APBT, is registered with the United Kennel Club in Kalamazoo, Michigan, just to put this in perspective. The same dog, I don't care what the breeders say because they very often double register them, the same dog can, in fact, be registered with the American Kennel Club as the American Staffordshire Terrier. It is a perfectly fine pet. It is a perfectly terrific dog, unless it has been selectively bred for violence Viciousness does not apply. Dogs are not vicious. People are. If it's been bred to be violent towards other animals, if it's been trained to be aggressive toward people, it is a monstrosity and should not be tolerated in any society because it's a walking time bomb.
Well, are pit bulls any easier to train towards violence than other breeds?
Yes, because they have been for eons fighting dogs, and they're very easily turned into monsters. Now, if you gave me that dog at birth, and I was able to pick it up, hold it, and carry it around for a few minutes, several times a day, and then my wife did it, and our housekeeper did it, and my mother-in-law did it, and socialized that dog beautifully, I guarantee you, socialize that dog to be Lassie. But, if I'm heavy-handed, if I'm a lout, if I'm a real redneck with violence in my soul, I can very easily, with no problem at all, turn that dog into an absolute monstrosity.
You're talking about abusing the dog.
I'm talking about, well, yeah, but I may not be torturing the dog. I may just be doing things to the dog that make it nasty, like throwing kittens in for it to kill. You know, that's what the fighting dog people do. Let there be no mistake about this. That's the way they're trained. They're given kittens to kill. Then they're given puppies to kill. And then they'll take something like a toy poodle and dangle it overhead on a pulley. And the pit bull jumps and jumps and jumps and tries it. And finally, it gets a hold of the little dog's head and tears his head off. That makes a fighting dog.
Once a pit bull has been then made into a fighting dog, can anything be undone about it? Because we certainly read in newspapers about pit bulls having to be shot after they have attacked a schoolyard full of children. And that was the only way to deal with this particular dog.
Well, the other way was to tranquilize it and bring it to a shelter and have it humanely destroyed with a needle. When the ASPCA raids a dog fight, and we do it all the time, and we get fighting dogs or fighting cocks from cockfights, we euthanize them. We do not consider that animal. I suppose that somebody who really wanted to love that animal could take it and work on it over a period of years with great care that it never got near another human being or another animal and could possibly turn it into, a nice pet. That's being so unlikely the case, and there being so very many of them, they are routinely euthanized, and I would think that's the only socially responsible thing to do. They're turned into monsters by human monsters. Mm-hmm. The people who fight them and use them in fights are human monsters. They have no souls, or they wouldn't do that.
Would you say, and I'm asking you this as president of the ASPCA, that the people are learning to treat their pets, their animals, better? Are you making strides in this whole sort of field of education about animals?
As compared to when?
I don't know. Is it compared to a generation ago?
Yeah. We still have problems. People still won't get their dogs spayed and neutered. They're still absolutely wacko on that subject. I think it's some kind of assault on their own manhood or womanhood or something to get dogs spayed and neutered. So we're still euthanizing a vast number of animals. They still abandon animals. They still allow animals to wander under circumstances and in places where they should never be allowed to wander. People who let them go in the city have not learned their lesson. People that don't spay and neuter have not learned their lesson. People who say dumb things like, well, we let her have a litter because we want our child to see the miracle of birth. Well, fine, let your child see the miracle of birth, then take the litter down to the shelter and have your child wait while they destroy the litter and let them see the miracle of death too, because that's what's going to happen to them. Don't take them in and say, fine, my dog, a good home, and wink so that you won't say something in front of the child. To tell the child, we're going to have this litter, and there are no homes for them. 13 million were killed last year, 15, whatever it was. So we'll have this litter, and you'll see how the mother does that, and then we'll take them down, and they'll kill them. Tell the child the truth of what kind of a monster you are. What a wonderful lesson to teach children, that living creatures are plastic goo-gaws to be thrown away when you're done playing with them, after you've broken them.
This seems like a very emotional issue for you.
It ain't easy.
Yeah. Is that the hardest part, perhaps, of being the president of the ASPCA? The kind of heartbreak of having to put down so many animals?
Oh, absolutely. We investigate cruelty cases, dog fighting, conch fighting, this maniacal thing called Santeria, where they bleed animals to death on an altar, some kind of voodoo ceremony. All of that is repulsive. It's infuriating, the carriage horses in the city, the abuses of them, and how difficult it is to enforce the laws and how weak and milquetoasty their laws are. It goes on and on. There are all kinds of problems. There's the occasional psychopath who soaks cats in lighter fluid and sets them on fire and throws animals off roofs. Those are anecdotal, and they're difficult to deal with, but we have law enforcement powers, and my men are armed, and women, and they can do something about that. But you can't do anything about a human psyche in this deteriorating human condition who look on animals as something to be tossed aside, thrown aside, abandoned, changed because the eyes are the wrong color or grew too big. We recently took in, at home, my wife and I, a Labrador Retriever. The people gave the Labrador Retriever up for euthanasia because they said it got bigger than they thought. Now, I want to ask you, anybody who's so stupid that they don't know how big a Labrador Retriever gets, or who is so stupid they wouldn't bother to find out how big a Labrador Retriever gets, they haven't got a right to anything. They're subhuman. And yes, that's the hardest part. Compensating for a deteriorating human condition.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today, Roger Karras. Thanks for joining us today on Fresh Air. I did have a question for you, but it's such a lighthearted one, I almost hate to ask it.
Ask it. Let's go on a high note.
Okay. I'm just curious how old you are in dog years.
In dog years?
Have you figured that out yet?
Well, by tradition, what is 7 times 64?
Well, let me pull out my calculator here.
7 times 64 is what?
You're 448.
I'm 448, but I don't feel a day over 445.
Thank you very much, Roger Karras, for joining us today.
Thank you, Marty.
Roger Karras' latest book is called A Dog is Listening. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.